Jacksonville marks the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, demonstrations and NBA walkouts are the backdrop to an important civil rights moment in Jacksonville. Give us a call as we discuss this extraordinary time in our city and America. It's 549-2937. Then later, what you need to know about changes to the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. 3,220 new cases of coronavirus reported across the state, including 229 in our area, and there have been 246 deaths linked to COVID-19 in the Jacksonville area. There were also 14 new hospitalizations in Duval County in the Wednesday report from the state health officials. But in Duval County, new cases have largely been trending downward, with four of the last 5 days seeing less than 5% of tests coming back positive in this county. That's good news. Amidst the pandemic, today marks the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday in Jacksonville. On this day in 1960, young demonstrators downtown calling for civil rights for African Americans were beaten by a white mob wielding baseball bats and axe handles. There will be a commemoration marking the anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday today in downtown James Weldon Johnson Park, the former Hemming Park, of course. And the anniversary comes as NBA players walk off the basketball court this week amid growing calls for racial justice. They are boycotting the postseason as a way to express their solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement and demonstrations we're seeing. We should also mention that as well as the NBA canceling games, the WNBA, Major League Baseball, and Major League Soccer have all postponed their games too in solidarity with this movement. This issue is especially potent after a Black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin named Jacob Blake was shot and seriously injured and potentially paralyzed for life by police, sparking demonstrations in that city that at times have become violent. A young white man is now charged with homicide after he opened fire on the demonstrators and killed two of them. Ken Jefferson is former spokesman for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, and he's the crime and safety analyst at our news partner, News for Jax Channel 4. Ken's on the line now as we talk about all of this. Hi, Ken. Good to have you back on the show.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
And as we talk about Axe Handle Saturday and the 60th anniversary in Jacksonville, the Black Lives Matter movement, and everything that's happening in America right now, we want your calls. 549-2937. Join us. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And Ken, you know, in a moment, I'd like to discuss with you today's event and take a look back to what happened in this city 60 years ago today. But first, you know, I think we need to note that it's really remarkable to be discussing the anniversary in the context of what's going on in the country right now. NBA players are walking off the court to protest the police killings of Black Americans. They have thrown the postseason into doubt. There is unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, after another man, Jacob Blake, was shot in the back 7 times, seriously injured by police. This was caught on video, as so many other of these incidents have been. As a former police official, what are your thoughts about the Black Lives Matter movement and how it's impacting our culture and our politics right now?
Well, people, excuse me, all over the world, not just African Americans, but Hispanic, white, all cultures from all nations are standing up now. They're looking at the injustices that has been going on for quite some time, the inequality of justice, all of the different things that's been going on with people, and it is actually amplified by these events with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and now Jacob Blake. All these things are amplifying this particular movement. This is a large movement of people who are standing up now. You know, back in the 60s, a lot of things were done, laws were passed by way of protesting, peaceful protesting. It got the attention of the legislators, it got the attention of the White House, it got everybody's attention because they were peaceful protesting, making their demands. And that's what is being replayed today. History is being replayed today. And unfortunately, for some of the same issues that they were marching for and protesting for way back then, we're still trying to address some of those issues.
Yeah. I mean, 60 years ago today, Axe Handle Saturday happened in downtown Jacksonville. Young activists, two of them have been vocal about what happened, and one of them is leading observances today, Rodney Hurst. He'll be leading the observance in Johnson Park today. But these were kids, teenagers, that were leading civil rights demonstrations in the city. They wanted basic human and civil rights, the right to eat at a downtown lunch counter, shop in a store, the right to vote, basic human dignity. They were beaten as they called for these rights and tried to integrate a downtown Jacksonville lunch counter. Activists will be observing this anniversary today at noon. By the way, we need to note that because of the pandemic, attendance in Johnson Park is limited to just a few dozen people. You can stream the event online. But you know, Ken, the Confederate statue in the park was taken down recently amidst this movement. The park has now been renamed from Hemming Park, a man with ties to the Confederacy, to James Weldon Johnson, a famous civil rights leader from Jacksonville. How do you reflect on these changes?
You know, I was 3 years old doing Axe Handle Saturday, and I can recall, I remember not understanding fully what was going on, but my mother telling me, go in the house, stay in the house. There's a lot of unrest going on, and we won't be going downtown for quite some time. And I couldn't understand it until I got a little bit older, but I remember seeing the images of these white men walking the streets of Jacksonville with axe handles and wreaking havoc on these folks. That wanted to some of the same rights that everybody else had, the human dignity, all the things that you just mentioned, which were not unreasonable asks, because it just wasn't being equal because of the color of our skin. So I remember that day, and I'm glad it's being commemorated today just to remind us of how far we've come, but also remind us of how much farther we have to go. We still got to come together. We still got to work together as a community. We all live here together. We all are human. We're all of one race, the human race. And it's because of hatred and division that causes us to separate ourselves. You know, no one person is better than the other because of the color of their skin. We're all in the human race. We all have equal rights under the law. We all look the same in God's eyes. So we still got a lot of work to do, but we've come a long way since then.
Yeah, we sure have. That said, as you pointed out, there are deep divisions in this country. Although the majority of Americans, polling shows, support Black Lives Matter and do believe that the extrajudicial killings of unarmed Black citizens is a real problem that needs addressing. At the same time, millions of Americans are reacting negatively to some of what we've seen in different protest uprisings around the country. The most recent flashpoint is Kenosha, Wisconsin, where, as you pointed out, Jacob Blake is the latest African-American citizen of this country to be unarmed and shot by police. He is alive, but he may be permanently paralyzed. After the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, demonstrations have erupted, and sometimes they become violent. Sometimes there's unrest. A 17-year-old white teen boy took a long gun into these protests in Kenosha and opened fire and killed two demonstrators. He's now facing homicide charges. He's being hailed, you know, and he's being hailed as a hero by some Americans this morning. And so I'd like to get your thoughts about this, because the nation is deeply divided right now in how they're perceiving these events unfold.
You know, we had civil unrest here in Jacksonville. We had peaceful protests, and we had rioting. And then when you look at the protests and the rioting all over the country, what's happening is the Black Lives Matter movement is the one being blamed for rioting and looting and whatever. Now, don't misunderstand me. There could be a few people that may have been involved with some of the illegal stuff, but most of those, the violent part is coming from outside sources. It's not the Black Lives Matter movement. Black Lives Matter movement is basically bringing attention to the issue that black lives are under attack right now. We're being treated disproportionately in the justice system, disproportionately in corporate America, and so on and so forth. That's what that movement is all about. But Black Lives Matter movement gets blamed and accused for everything that's happening in a violent situation. You take the instance of Kenosha, Wisconsin, where this 17-year-old white male shot and killed two people. And I was talking to a source yesterday who was in Wisconsin who basically said that he came from Illinois. This guy, 17-year-old, came from Illinois with a long barrel gun just to do what he did. And after he did it, he ran to the police and said, hey, there's shooting over there, and the police not knowing that he was the shooter. And he got away and left Wisconsin and went back to Illinois. Not until video surfaced and witnesses surfaced were they able to connect him as the shooter, because there's actual video of him doing that, connect him as the shooter, and made the arrest and charged with first-degree murder. But initially, what the police did was went and grabbed a couple of African-Americans after the 17-year-old said they're shooting, and they had the wrong person. So my point is, these were peaceful protesters being accused of something that they didn't do, and that's what's happening all over. So Black Lives Matter should not be an intimidating factor or an intimidating force in anybody's mind, because all they want is for equal justice, equal rights.
Let's go to your calls now for Ken Jefferson, Channel 4's crime and safety analyst, former spokesman for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Today's the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday in Jacksonville. Amidst national protests and discussion about the Black Lives Matter movement. 549-2937. Conrad is on the north side. Hi, Conrad. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. I told the lady that I needed to have north side in Arlington because I usually get calls from me in my business in Arlington. But I grew up in the old county out north of Trout River, Broward River. And I was working at a drugstore at the corner of 65th and Main those days, and especially on Axe Handle Saturday, I was on the soda fountain there, and people were pouring out of downtown with absolute abject horror on their faces. They had gotten downtown and run into all us. I want to praise the Times Union for coming clean after 60 years for these articles the last several days about how much cover-up there has been known by certain people in the hierarchy of the Times Union when they would not print. The white people in this town probably knew less about what was going on during those days than the black faction was getting through things like the Florida Star.
Yeah. You're right. The TU didn't even cover it, although newspapers around the country did.
Time, Life, and New York Times, I've got to get those and look at them because we weren't told about that at the time. I was a senior at Jackson High School. Tommy Azuri was a year behind me there at the same time. Last year there was a fellow that had a letter in the Times Union, and I want to answer this year. He's a pharmacist down south now, but he was a black student at Stanton in his senior year the same time I was at Jackson. And he posed a question a year ago about where was the discourse. And that's something I remember discussing with some of my friends when we went back to school that next week, because we went back after Labor Day in those days. But I remember bringing that up to some people who were a little bit open about why we never had any crossing of those lines between the black and white communities, except by some somewhat surreptitious maneuvering by people like Andy Johnson's family out in Dinsmore going back to the 1940s. But there was never there was no place to have an open discussion.
Yeah, everything was segregated. I mean, that was the whole point of the demonstrations. Wait, I want to ask you, though, Conrad.
The segregation, okay, all right.
But I want to ask you more about your memories of that day. Tell me exactly where you were working and what you saw.
I was at 65th and Main soda fountain, and these people were coming in there. Especially, we'd been hearing things for two or three days about young black element that was acting up downtown, was about the way it was described. And it was because this had been going on for two or three weeks with this thing of attempted sit-ins following what had been done in Charlotte. But the biggest thing was the Saturday in those days, there's been an allegation in the Times Union about how the downtown in Jacksonville has been so depressed for so long. That was what happened on this day in 1960. Well, what really happened that day was this was like a big country town in those days, and people from all the way up to the Georgia line and down south poured into downtown Jacksonville right there to that park. And those shops, it was the focus of all the major shopping. Sears had just built the largest store in the southeast down on Bay Street. All this was drawing people in, especially on that Saturday, and they were just totally terrified by what they walked into downtown. And then, you know, the Jacksonville police were useless. They were directly under the thumb of the mayor, who was the police commissioner. There were six police chiefs who were useless. The cop that you see in that one picture with the fellow with the blood on him was a county patrolman. They were the deputy sheriffs. They never, ever entered downtown. That was four patrolled by the Jacksonville police. They were not doing anything but standing by that day, letting all this stuff happen. I was surprised. I've never seen a picture yet of a JPD officer that was there doing anything besides watching. And I would also like to include that I think the majority of the people with these axe handles and these KKK connections that have turned up after all these years probably came from two counties west of here, which is a breeding ground for the Klan and has been forever.
Conrad, I want to thank you for sharing your memories of that day and your thoughts about everything we're discussing. That's Conrad in Arlington, Northside. So, Ken, it's really powerful to get testimonies like that and memories from someone who was there. What do you think about Conrad's perspective?
I was actually really intrigued at some of the facts that he's pouring out, because there was very little local media coverage of the event. It went national. This was, as we would say today, this was a viral story. And I would have to give credibility to what he said also about distractors coming in from out of town, wreaking havoc. Generally speaking, that's how things generally occur when you have violence with looting and fires and vandalism and things like that. It's usually distractors coming in outside of your city. There are some within the city that does participate in that, but the majority of people come from out of the city that's being affected. But I was very intrigued by his memory, his recollection of all those things. And he's right. You had, at that time, this was before consolidation, so you had the Jacksonville Police Department and you had the Duval County Road Patrol. The city had not been consolidated then, and there was no JSO, Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, so you had these different departments. And the picture that he's talking about, I think that was Mr. Griffin, who was bloody. I can't remember his first name. That was Mr. Griffin, who gave an account of him just being surrounded by all these guys.
Right. It's the iconic photo from that day. Young African-American teen all bloodied up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he recollects that he didn't really know what was going on. He wasn't in the store at the time, but he was trying to get out of there, and they surrounded him and beat him. But I want to add this one last thing. At the old Hemming Plaza, I can recall going with my mother to the Woolworth store where the fit-in was. We would shop around about this time of year because it was during the summer school. It was during summer when we were out of school, so we would shop for school clothes. She had to shop for all of us, which was seven of us. And I can recall going there shopping with my mother, and we would catch the bus right there at Hemming Plaza. And I wanted to use the bathroom one day, My mother would not allow me to use the bathroom. There was a sign that says colors only, and it was in the basement of the park. And I couldn't understand it. I was 3 years old. I couldn't, three or four years old. I couldn't understand why I couldn't go down and use the bathroom. But typically, there were always someone down there, a white person down there, waiting to fight any black person that came in that bathroom, even though it said colors only. You couldn't go anywhere else. You couldn't drink from certain fountains. I remember those days as though it was yesterday. So I'm glad we've made progress. We don't see those kind of signs anymore. We don't have those kind of direct issues. We just got other systemic issues that's going on right now, as opposed to the blatant disregard of a human race that we had back in the 60s.
Brian is in San Marco. Hi, Brian. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yeah, all due respect, you know, I know that history has, you know, lots of things in it, but it's not 1965, it's 2020. And what I want to ask you, Melissa, is have you actually watched the videos out of Kenosha, Wisconsin? Have you actually watched the videos of Kyle Rittenhouse?
I have, and that's why I noted that these protests have at times turned violent. And we have watched this. Now, wait a minute. That does not mean that it's okay for someone to open fire on a crowd of demonstrators. This young man is charged with homicide.
He didn't open fire. If you've actually watched the video, he didn't open fire on a crowd of demonstrators. He was chased. The first video I saw, look, you know, I would say he had a Molotov cocktail thrown at him. He was running away. The second video I saw, a group of 8 or 10 guys chasing him down, saying they were going to beat him up. He was running the other direction. You know, obviously there'll be more video. Who knows?
And apparently he shot somebody who was in the process of robbing a store in the head. So he took matters into his own hands, Brian. He wasn't a police officer. He was a vigilante.
What do you expect people to do when they're burning cities down?
Well, let's ask Ken about that, because Ken is a former police officer. Ken, I appreciate the thought, Brian. Go ahead, Ken.
Here's the thing. You don't come to a protest with a gun, number one, because you obviously have ill intentions, or you feel that you're going to be attacked and you want to be able to defend yourself. So, number one, you don't come to a protest with a gun. Number two, the reason why, Brian, he was being chased because he had just shot somebody. They were chasing the gunman. He wasn't being chased initially because he was white and he was there at the protest. He had just shot a man in the head, and witnesses saw it, and they were trying to chase him. While he was running, he fell down. When he fell down, he began to shoot randomly. That's how the other casualties came about. So after he did that, he got away, and he told police as he's running that they're shooting over there. Somebody's shooting over there. He fled back to Illinois, and they were able to make the connection to him, to who he was, and they went the next day and made the arrest.
Yeah, and apparently he drove from Illinois to Kenosha.
Correct.
He's not from there. And so, you know, he drove there apparently with the intent to...
To do harm.
Now, but let me ask you, Ken... Because, as I said, there's a divide in this country as to how you see what's happening in cities like Kenosha. We just heard from that caller, Brian. What else? He said something along the lines of, what else are people supposed to do when they're watching a city burn? And so I'm not saying that I agree with those Americans who feel affinity for what this young accused murderer did. But there are millions of Americans who agree with that caller. They believe, I think inaccurately, but they believe that it's reached a point in this country where vigilantes, citizens who do not have color of law, are it's justified that they can be empowered to go in and try to restore order to cities that are flashpoints for these protests. This is a disturbing moment we're in. And, you know, I would like to get your thoughts answering the concerns and the perceptions of callers like Brian, who seem to have some sympathy for this young 17-year-old accused killer.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. Here's the bottom line, Melissa. You cannot take matters into your own hands as citizens. That's why we have police. That's why we have governing officials. You know, the basic instinct is, oh my gosh, I've got to protect my city, I've got to protect my property, whatever. I'm going to do whatever I can to protect it. But when you've got hundreds or thousands of people protesting, you can't take matters into your own hands. You can't. You know, I agree with peaceful protesting. People have the right under the Constitution to peacefully protest. When things get out of hand, when rioting and looting and violence occur, that's when you allow the law enforcement officers to come in and do their job, be it federal, state, or local. You allow them to do their job. That's what their obligation and their oath is. You, as a private citizen, can't do that. We see that with the situation going on in Brunswick right now with Ahmaud Arbery. You know, citizens decide they want to take matters in their own hands and do what they did. Now they're facing charges, you know.
Right. They perceived that Ahmaud Arbery was walking into a house under construction. They felt inappropriately. And so, according to the charges, they shot him for it.
Correct.
Just for people that haven't followed that. Yeah.
And that's the example. That's the example of people taking matters in their own hands, trying to do what law enforcement officials are trained and sworn to do. You just can't do that. This guy came in with ill intent because he had a weapon on him. His objective was to shoot somebody, and that's what he did. But he didn't just hit one person. He hit more than one person. So when you look at videos and you see the account of things, my source was directly there and sent me a copy of the actual video, more than what Brian saw, because these persons were there on official business, and they were there at the last news conference that was held yesterday. So I had a little more information than the average person on that. But still, if I didn't have that information, looking at it on the surface, you do not go to a protest armed with a weapon unless you intend to use it, unless you intend to wreak some kind of havoc. I mean, was he going to hide behind a building or something and try to snipe people, or was he just there to have that as a defense mechanism against someone that would try to do harm to him? We don't know. But what we do know is that he came there and he shot several people, and he's going to be charged for it.
He is facing charges. So the system is holding him accountable. All of that said, today is the anniversary of Axe Handle in Jacksonville. On this day, the Jacksonville Youth Council NAACP held sit-ins to try to integrate downtown lunch counters and were attacked for that. There will be events in Johnson Park downtown from noon to 2. Because of the pandemic, attendance in the park is limited to 50 people, so you are encouraged to look at it virtually and stream it instead of going down there to the park in person. And Ken, you know, it's just an extraordinary time in this country. And we all need to take a deep breath, I think.
We need to take a deep breath. We need to take a step back and look at where we are today in this country. But most of all, look at where we've come from. Yeah, the fight continues. The struggle continues. Systemic racism still exists, but you have to admit it has gotten a little better. That's not satisfying enough, because it could be better than what it is now. You know, until we get equality for everyone, until the disparity in the criminal justice system balances out, until women have the same rights as men, with due respect, until we get equal on every level, the fight is going to continue. And when we see images such as Jacob Blake, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, when we see those images constantly coming up, these things constantly still happening, that just intensifies the movement. And you've got those who feel that violence is the only way. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to be violent amidst the peaceful protesters that's going on. So until we can balance it all out, step back, take a deep breath, realize that we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. Let's work together on it. Until we do that, it's not going to get any better.
Always appreciate your thoughts, Ken. Thank you so much for calling in this morning.
Thank you, Melissa.
Ken Jefferson, the crime and safety analyst at News for Jax, with us today. Much more still ahead later. It's a national effort to save the news. We'll tell you about it. But up next.
This program's unlike anything the SBA has ever done before. It's unlike anything the Treasury has done or banks have done.
We've got the latest on the PPP, or Paycheck Protection Program, what it means for your business, after this.
First Coast Home Pros guarantees excellence in each of their professional home cleaning services, including carpet cleaning, grout cleaning, and more. More at firstcoasthomepros.com. Our goal is to be the best service company you've ever invited into your home.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Since the pandemic began in March, business owners have been taking advantage of the PPP, Paycheck Protection Program, to pay their employees. One financial institution alone, Iberia Bank, has approved more than $2.1 billion worth of these loans to thousands of applicants. On Monday, the U.S. Small Business Administration and U.S. Treasury issued an interim final rule addressing PPP forgiveness issues. There's a lot to get into with this process. I spoke about it with Abel Harding, North Florida Market President at Iberia Bank.
Abel, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And I know you're getting a lot of questions about this. How is Iberia Bank preparing for forgiveness?
Sure. So what we've done is stay on top of the communications that we've received from the Small Business Administration and from the U.S. Treasury Department. We've worked diligently to communicate those to our associates across our footprint, the lenders that are really the face, the front line, to our clients, and we've worked hard to drive communications through to our clients so they're continuously hearing from us about what we're doing. And in the background, our teams have been running testing and all kinds of things to make sure that we're ready as a company for the process when the time is right to throw the switch.
Right, to flip the switch. So will forgiveness require the same resources that the PPP applications called for? Will this be the same setup?
Well, you know, certainly from a manpower perspective in the banking industry, we hope not.
Yeah.
In the first, when we did the application process, if you drew an Iberia Bank or a First Horizon paycheck, you were on the team as part of the application process, whether your job was public relations or marketing or finance, it really didn't matter. You were part of the process.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that all hands on deck. Wow.
We had our head of finance, was answering emails from clients about the application process. It ran the gamut. But, you know, this time what we've worked hard is to put a technology and solution in place. And so we're hopeful this will be a more efficient process and not require the manpower, certainly, that we required on the front end.
One thing we've all learned to live with is being flexible in this pandemic. Could the guidelines change again? Are you prepared to pivot and react to more changes that could be coming?
That's a great question. And, you know, if we've learned anything through this process, this program's unlike anything the SBA has ever done before. It's unlike anything the Treasury has done or banks have done. And so tweaks and changes in guidelines are inevitable. So certainly we anticipate that forgiveness will be no different. There are still unanswered questions out there. There's speculation. You know, if you follow financial media and financial news, there's still a lot of speculation about the types of loans and potential forgiveness questions. And so we anticipate there will be changes, and that's why we're holding back, which most of our peer banks and are doing the same thing, is waiting to get comfort with the interpretation from the SBA before we're ready to move forward.
What's your advice then for your customers and for businesses that are hoping that they can have their loans forgiven through this process?
Well, you know, one thing we've stressed from the very beginning, from the pre-application process, is the need for clear record keeping. So in forgiveness will be no different. Documentation is going to be very crucial. It's a crucial piece of this. So what businesses can be doing now is to make sure you have complete payroll records. If you use a payroll service, get with them. Make sure that you've got complete records through the whole process to back up, you know, what you've done. Make sure you have clear accounting of all the dollars that were received as part of this program and exactly how they were spent, what categories, what they fit into. And if any dollars remain, make sure that you have, you know, that you know exactly what those dollars are and where they're sitting. The need for clear and full documentation is an absolute as part of this. And this is something that everyone can be working on now.
Yeah, get your ducks in a row. That is so important. What are the biggest pain points out there that you're hearing from your customers and from businesses? What are they dealing with right now?
Well, I mean, it really depends what sector you're talking about. This pandemic has not impacted everyone in the same way. As we know, we've certainly, everyone knows that from an individual level. Certain people have had a harder time than others. But from the business sector, you know, we've seen some industries that we know well, you know, some of the medical sector was shut down for quite a bit of time and was not open if it was not COVID-related. Certainly the hospitality sector was hit hard. Bars and restaurants, you think of, you know, tap rooms and different things like that, they're still not reopened. So there is concern. Anytime you have a lot of unknown, there's going to be concern, and there certainly is. But at the same time, I think we've started seeing some cautious optimism from a lot of our clients, particularly as we continue to hear more promising news about potential for a vaccine, and I think there's a lot of hope that we soon can move beyond this, or at least get to a point where our economy can fully open and everybody you know can be working again and doing their best to keep us moving forward.
Right, that's certainly what we all want. Well, thanks for this timely information. He's Abel Harding, North Florida Market President at Iberia Bank here in Jacksonville. Thanks, Abel.
Thank you.
Well, thousands of communities across the country have seen local newspapers struggle or even go under financial pressures of decreased ad revenue, hedge fund ownership, and most recently the pandemic. Despite all this, the Times Union continues to report the news, and they recently did a huge public service to the community when they revealed the secret deals behind the now canceled attempt to privatize JEA. There's a federal investigation because of their work. The public service local news provides is exactly why the News Guild, a union representing thousands of journalists, is fighting to save the news. They're pushing for congressional support of two key bills that would include more newsrooms in the next recovery package. Reporter David Bauerlein of the Times Union's News Guild unit is on the line with more. Hi, David.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. So you want Congress to save the news, include newsrooms in their next stimulus package. What's the latest on this?
Well, right now it's still in the U.S. Senate. It does have 10 co-sponsors, half of them Republican, half of them Democrat, so it's got some bipartisan support. And obviously we're very anxious to see that newsrooms, not just print, but also radio and TV broadcasts to provide vital local news, that the people who are behind the lines working to produce that can be able to gain some protection through what's been called the Paycheck Protection Program, which currently does not offer that type of coverage to newsrooms. And we would very much like to see that be something that's made available to the people who are working hard in the trenches delivering local news every day to their communities they serve.
That's right. The Times Union, despite all of the financial pressures it's under, has done incredible work in recent years in particular. the JEA investigation, I think, at the very apex of the journalism that the TU is producing. You have saved this community a lot of money, and you've exposed corruption. I think that's just the latest example of the value this newspaper of record provides to Northeast Florida. And it's an important civic institution that we must protect, David.
Well, I really appreciate those kind words, Melissa. And it's the JEA has stood out for sure among readers. But, you know, we've covered the COVID-19 pandemic, tried to provide a lot of information there. Certainly we've been doing that with the school district. And so there's a lot of different aspects of what we cover that we feel are really important to, you know, an educated electorate, for instance, when people go to the polls. But we have really had some real cuts over recent years, and even before the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, in the last 3 years, we've had 36 people who have left the newsroom for various reasons. So we've lost 5 sports people, 4 editors, 4 editorial page staffers, 3 photo staffers, 3 criminal justice reporters, our whole business staff, you know, our suburban reporters, our military reporters, among others. And, you know, today we just have 27 staffers, including management, and 23 of those are in the News Guild. So we have really faced a lot of downsizing, which has been systemic throughout the industry. And, yeah, we're still alive and kicking, and we have dedicated people who show up to work every day. But it would really help to be able to have some kind of assistance, like other businesses are getting,
to the
local news industry, to be able to weather this storm and try to come out on the other side of it and keep doing it.
And if everyone listening values local news, this is easy. Go to savethenews.org, savethenews.org, and click the button Take Action. Enter your name and address and let your senator know that you support SB 3718, the Local News and Emergency Information Act of 2020. Expanding access of PPP loans to local news outlets like the Times Union. I just clicked on this, David, and I just fired off my little missive to Florida senators and the sponsors of Save the News. So I encourage everyone to do it.
Thank you very much, Melissa, and thank you for giving us a chance to spread the word about this to your listeners as well.
Absolutely. Read the TU, subscribe to the TU, and go to savethenews.org. Click Take Action and send a letter to your senators. Tell them you want them to support Senate Bill 3718. David Bauerlein with the Times Union's News Guild Unit letting us know about this. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Appreciate it.
A quick break, and in a moment, we talked earlier about Axe Handle Saturday and the racial justice movement of today. It's being supported not only by a demonstration today at noon, but also a new public art project here in Jacksonville. We'll tell you about that in just a moment.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
Despite a recent spike, Greece has managed to keep its virus case numbers pretty low. And that has the Greek people feeling pretty good.
I think we trust the state a lot more than we used to.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. From debt crisis to COVID crisis, the story from Athens, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9. On the next Fresh Air, a new strategy devised by epidemiologists and economists to defeat COVID-19 even before a vaccine is found. We talk with Alexis Madrigal about his latest article in The Atlantic and about his work as co-founder of the COVID-19 Tracking Project, which collects and publishes data from all 50 states about COVID testing and patient outcomes. Join us.
Today at noon, here on WJCT News 89.9.
What it means to miss New Orleans.
It's been 15 years since Hurricane Katrina crashed into New Orleans, leaving both the city and the region forever changed. Now it's another hurricane season. As natural disasters get worse and worse, are we any better prepared? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, on this 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday, the local art gallery Yellow House is launching a new arts activism project. It's called Sit In, Stand Up. These public art posters are available to look at online, and they will also be placed around town. They commemorate the sit-ins for civil rights decades ago, but also their strong connections to the movement for racial justice today. With more, I spoke with Hope McMath, founder of Yellow House. Hope McMath, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Melissa.
And with the 60th anniversary of the sit-ins in Jacksonville around Axe Handle Saturday, there's a lot happening around town this week. You're commemorating it as well at Yellow House. What's happening there?
Yeah, so we had plans to do an exhibition in partnership with Rodney Hurst around the 60th anniversary of both the sit-ins and Axe Handle Saturday. But as COVID has Yellow House still closed to the public, we decided to plow through and continue to do the work. And so we have developed two exhibitions that will live in a virtual format online, but also live physically in the streets. And the first exhibit is called Sit In, Stand Up, and it is a collection of posters designed by local graphic designers that are inspired both by Axe Handle Saturday, but also the current movement for racial justice. And then the second exhibition is entitled It's Still Not About a Hot Dog and a Coke, and it really does a deeper dive into Axe Handle Saturday and how we see ripples from that in today's demonstrations and demands for justice in Jacksonville.
Now, you said these images are online, but also in the streets, so people can go physically see them somewhere out in public. Where can they check that out?
So the online exhibitions contain images, statistics, quotes. In the Axe Handle focused exhibition, Rodney Hurst, we are actually recording him doing readings from his first book. So it's really intimate and really powerful. And the In the Streets is going to be more organic. So a lot of the posters that have been designed for this exhibition will begin to pop up in demonstrations and marches happening throughout our region. Some of those same posters are already popping up as wheat paste art on buildings and other structures throughout the urban core. And then they will end up living eventually in an exhibition at Yellow House, and some of it will be on exhibition at the UNF galleries. So really over the next couple of months, people will see them pop up in kind of unexpected ways, literally on the street. And then they will then get to see them once we are a bit back on track in the space of some of our more traditional galleries.
Nice. And Rodney Hurst, of course, was the youth leader of the NAACP in 1960 and led those sit-in demonstrations and was one of the young people attacked by the racist mob on Axe Handle Saturday. And so he'll be a big part of all these observances. And then, as you mentioned, Yellow House, your organization, is looking forward to reopening. Can you tell us a little bit about that, too?
We are. We have continued to do our work during the closure, but because our physical space is one that is intimate and really created for the convening of people, it just has not made sense for us to be open yet. We really hold up as a core belief community care, and so we just didn't feel like we could really do what we needed to create a safe space for folks. So we've been doing our work out in community and through lots of virtual programs. And so in September, we are going to begin to open our space in a more controlled way where people will have to let us know that they're coming so that we can make sure that we limit the numbers of people in the building. But as we are also about to celebrate our third year anniversary, we're hearing from a lot of people that they miss being engaged with us physically. So on the first weekend of September, we will be doing sort of a drive-by celebration and limited access to the building to see the exhibitions.
That's great. And in the meantime, people can go to yellowhouseart.org and look at this new poster collection commemorating the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday and also the way you've connected it to the racial justice movement of today. These are really compelling pieces of art, and check them out virtually. And as Hope said, you'll also be seeing them pop up around town, which is adding to public art in Jacksonville. So Hope McMath, it's always good to hear your voice. Thank you so much for telling us all about this. We appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks for always shining the light.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening, and to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. She's off this week up in the North Carolina mountains. We miss her. Josh Torres keeps us all on pace. He's our show director. Our news director, Jessica Palumbo, oversees everything around here. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor, always working hard. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We appreciate your feedback. You can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8, or our podcast will be up later today, wherever you get yours. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow to connect with you then. In the meantime, have a great Thursday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.